vocation, and suffering can really make us listen more carefully to what our real vocation is. Perhaps you'll find meaning in working for the environment, working for social justice. Those kind of activities can be discovered and can make life meaningful. And clearly, your life can be meaningful, but not necessarily happy. A meaningful life and a happy life are not necessarily the same thing. Think of Mother Teresa, for example. Extremely meaningful life, I don't think you could have said it was very happy, particularly. So you have to find that your life has meaning and purpose, it matters in some way, to make suffering tolerable. It used to be the case, of course, that traditional religions would give us all the answers that we needed. That if you had this kind of question, your priest or minister could tell you what the answer is. Now people have to discover meaning for themselves. And this can be a healthy process, or it can occur during the midst of intense suffering. Many people are going through their daily lives, but they find that their life and their pursuits have become kind of hollow and empty, and so on. And in fact, this has become so important nowadays that some people are talking about illnesses like cancer and heart disease and autoimmune diseases as diseases of meaning, that they occur at some point when people start to feel that their life is pointless and meaningless and so on. For example, some theorists have talked about illness as the result of being in what they call a life trap. A life trap is when you're in a situation like that's unbearable, but you can't get out of it, like a loveless marriage, a meaningless job, or some kind of dilemma like that, where you feel completely stuck and unable to deal with the situation, but unable to get out of it. It's thought that that kind of meaninglessness can trigger serious illnesses by overwhelming the immune system's capacity to cope. The immune system is very sensitive to chronic stress. And if you chronically are stressed emotionally in that kind of situation, the immune system sometimes can't take it and illnesses can take hold. This search for meaning can sometimes be unsuccessful. Sometimes people search for meaning for years after the death of a loved one or something like that, and they never make sense of the situation. Sometimes unpleasant consequences happen then, alcohol abuse or drug abuse or suicide. And it doesn't matter what the answer is that you find. What matters is that you find some kind of answer. That seems to be the helpful thing. Then you can improve your life satisfaction and your general health tends to improve. Otherwise, if you're in a prolonged state of despair and helplessness and resentment, these states of mind will reactivate illness. But if you can develop some hope and sense of purpose and meaning, and gratitude in particular is very important, that those states of mind benefit you if you have some kind of illness. The other important point is that you can discover positive meaning or negative meaning. Positive meaning is any meaning that fosters well-being, affirms the value of your life, gives you a goal, a sense that life is coherent. But some people discover negative meaning. They tell me that they've become bitter, they've become cynical, they can't trust people. And negative meaning inhibits normal growth and creativity, and it leads to powerlessness and hopelessness, and those states of mind, as I say, predispose to illness. Now, Jung wrote a great deal about this issue of meaning. He says that meaning makes suffering bearable. Lack of meaning is what he calls soul sickness. As I mentioned the other day, he thinks that symptoms like anxiety and depression are messages from the self or from the unconscious that something needs attention. If he's right about that, then we can trust our suffering, actually, that it has some teleological purpose. Otherwise, the symptom is just something to get rid of. Jung said that about a third of the people who consulted him were suffering from what he called the senselessness and aimlessness of their lives. He says the soul suffers when it stagnates spiritually, and we have to find the meaning that quickens, that enlivens the soul. This is a quote from him, from MDR. Meaninglessness inhibits the fullness of life and is therefore equivalent to illness. Meaning makes a great many things endurable, perhaps everything. Another important writer in this area is Viktor Frankl, who we mentioned briefly yesterday. I think he went a little bit over the top. He said that he thought that meaning, the striving to find meaning, is the most important motivation in human beings, the thing that is the most important driving factor. I think that's probably an exaggeration, but I think it's certainly very important. He arrived at this idea during his time in a Nazi death camp, when he noticed that prisoners were more likely to survive if their survival had some meaning. It might be that they hoped to reunite with a loved one, or maybe just that they could help other inmates, but they have to have some, they have to have some goal in life to give it meaning. They had to maintain some degree of hope. And those people who could do that had a much better chance of survival than people who had lost all meaning. That's where he arrived at this. Now, he was an existentialist, really. He thought that we can choose our attitude to suffering. He believed that people are radically free and self-determined, and that we can choose this. A lot of people are not so sure that we have that degree of free will, but that's an important debate. Now, I'd like to talk about another idea that's important in the Jungian community, which is suffering as an archetypal process of what's called liminality. I'm sorry I can't write the word down. Liminality is spelt L-I-M-I-N-A-L-I-T-Y. It means a threshold state. And it's a term that was borrowed from the anthropologists, from a guy called Arnold van Gennep, who was studying rites of passage in the first part of the 20th century in tribal cultures. And he noticed that all these rites, I'm talking about rites of passage rituals where you make a boy into a man or a girl into a woman or somebody, you change the status of somebody with a ritual process. He noticed that these had a threefold pattern, what we would now call an archetypal pattern. First, the individual is taken out of their usual situation. Then they go through this liminal period, which is a betwixt and between state, a threshold state. And then after the ritual is over, the third stage is called reincorporation. They go back into the tribe or the society in the new status. So it's now regarded as an archetypal process of change. Something happens that takes you out of your ordinary situation, like a death or a divorce or the sudden onset of an illness, something like that. Then you go through this liminal period, this period of transition. Eventually, you'll come back into the society with an established different consciousness. But it's this middle period, the liminal period, of what's often called betwixt and between. There's a good book on the subject called Betwixt and Between. And people always break down emotionally during these periods of transition. That's when we human beings are most vulnerable, during periods of unexpected change in particular. The word liminal comes from the Latin word limen, L-I-M-E-N, which means a threshold, like being on the threshold of a house where you're not quite in and not quite out. So when you're in the liminal period, you're not fully out of the new status in life. You're not fully in the new position. Well, if this notion that this is an archetypal process is correct, then suffering can be seen as actually as a process of initiation that's trying to move the individual into a new state of consciousness. Now, in tribal cultures, these rites of passage are really quite terrifying. The initiate is subjected to all kinds of brutal tortures, both in boys and girls initiations. But I won't bore you with the gory details. The book on it is by Eliade. It's called Rites and Symbols of Initiation. But they do horrifying things to these people. And the ones that survive will have their consciousness changed, and they'll be reincorporated into the tribe with a whole new consciousness. And that's thought to be what's going on from this point of view when we are plunged into a period of suffering or liminality. The idea is to change consciousness, to initiate us into a new state of being. And there are lots of forms of liminality. Any major life transition. So we mentioned briefly the story of Inanna yesterday, the Sumerian goddess who went down to the underworld. That was her transition into liminality. And eventually she was reincorporated with a radically new consciousness. I wouldn't really have time to go into that whole story, but the theme of descent and change in the underworld and then coming back into the social order as a different person is well known mythologically. So I just want to talk about the issue that was mentioned the other day. I can't remember who mentioned the issue of radical acceptance, but I think this is a very important idea. There are occasions in life when you're suffering intensely, you've tried everything that's possible, you've done all the common sense things you can think of, gotten all the help that you can get, but you've exhausted all possibilities. There's nothing left that you can do. Okay, intense suffering persists. The radical notion of radical acceptance can become a very useful alternative here, not only for spiritually oriented people, but even for atheists as well. It means being totally receptive to the situation you're in, with no resistance, letting go completely of any form of resistance. Because very often what we find is it's not only the suffering which is causing the problem, it's the resistance to the suffering, the friction that's caused by resistance, which adds to suffering. So I'm not talking about passivity here. I'm not talking about doing nothing. I'm assuming that you've done all the things you can do, but you realize that you have no further control over the situation. The ship is leaving and there's no point in clinging to the dock. Something like that. Struggle is futile. We stop trying to control the situation. We just allow it to unfold the way it's going to unfold. So it's a form of spiritual surrender. A lot of people don't like the word surrender because they think it's too militaristic. It has connotations of defeat and failure. In a culture that, like ours, that values autonomy and mastery and control and so on, I would tend to avoid the word surrender, and I prefer the classical spiritual term of letting go. There are certain painful states of mind and body that simply have to be accepted. Sometimes when they are accepted, they may change, but sometimes they don't change. You can't let go in order to change something. Then you're not really letting go. If you're letting go, you really have to let go. A good example of this that I've seen is in people with chronic pain. I discovered recently that in some surveys, as many as 30% of people in this country have some kind of chronic pain. It's an unbelievably high number. And it varies. I mean, in some of us, it's just a minor inconvenience, whereas in other people it's incapacitating and they can't get relief from it, which is why we have the opioid epidemic. So, and you can be anywhere on this spectrum. Anyway, so some people with chronic pain get to a point where they do all the usual medical things that you can do, but they get to a point where they realize they're going to have to live with the pain. It's not going away. Okay, I have to learn from this pain. There's no point in my constantly fighting it, that kind of thing. I have to open to the pain. I have to let go of resistance to it. I have to carry on my ordinary everyday activities without avoiding the pain. And when people can do that, that's a process of spiritual surrender or letting go. They actually have good pain-related outcomes. Now, so in any difficult situation, maturity demands that you make a judgment or discernment. Should I try to master the situation? Should I try to manage it? Should I try to let go? What are my resources? When you are committed to a traditional religion, you can let go as a means of connecting to the transpersonal dimension, to what you perceive as divine will. Whether you consider that to be the Judeo-Christian God or Christ or Jung's self or your true nature, if you're a Buddhist, or doesn't matter what you call it, some form of higher power. And the process has beneficial psychological effects, even for atheists, by the way, because it provides a kind of adaptation to the situation, which is helpful. And you can tell that this has happened, by the way, because the atmosphere around the suffering person becomes less tense. They become freer and more open. And you sense that the struggle is ending. I wanted to leave a little time for a conversation. There is a debate in the literature about whether this can happen as an act of will. Can you surrender volitionally? It's called volitional surrender. Or whether spontaneous surrender can only happen as an act of grace, that it happens to you, it's given to you. It's not something, you can decide to surrender, but nothing may happen. You know, it might be like a dog trying to catch its own tail. Sometimes the ego can't let go of itself. But sometimes surrender can happen spontaneously as an act of grace. It can happen, I think, as a result of spiritual practice like prayer or meditation. It can just come over the individual. And it feels as if something gives way inside the person. Sometimes gradually, sometimes instantaneously. I found this nice quote in William James in Varieties of Religious Experience. The process of surrender is frequently sudden and automatic and leaves on the subject an impression that he has been wrought by an external power. So I thought that was a nice way of, maybe we should end there and we would have a quarter of an hour for conversation about this. Sorry, I couldn't hear you. Oh, the quote from William James, yes. The process of surrender is frequently sudden and automatic and leaves on the subject an impression that he has been wrought by an external power. That's in Varieties, page 121. I have a few more points, but maybe we should spend the rest of the time talking. Yes.